Today's episode of the Axon Creative Podcast is brought to you by FreshBooks. Join the 24 million people who've used FreshBooks. Try it free for 30 days with no catch and no credit card required. All you have to do is go to freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental creative in the how did you hear about us section. Hey everyone, welcome to the Axon Creative Podcast. My name is Todd Henry. I am your host. So when you think about the word legacy, what comes to mind? Legacy can seem big. It can seem far off in the distance. It can seem like something that we get to at some point. It's something that other people talk about when we're gone. But the reality is our legacy is something we're building every single day through every decision that we make. Today's guest is Lucas Conley, and he's going to talk to us about what it means to be a legacy in the making. Lucas works for the Legacy Lab, and he's written a book called Legacy in the Making. And it's all about how brands and businesses and even individuals, I find, can be mindful of the legacy that they are building and how they can become basically a modern brand and interact more meaningfully with the people that they are trying to serve. So we're going to dive into that conversation in just a minute. Hey, did you know that I have a daily show? It's called The Daily Creative. You can subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. It comes out Monday through Friday. It's just a quick 1 to 3, sometimes 5, if I feel wordy on a given day, 1 to 3 to 5 minute tip about how to be prolific, brilliant, and healthy. Just a way to get your day started right. It comes out at 4 o'clock Eastern every single morning. And we just recorded the episodes for April, and they are basically listener questions. We got a ton of questions from people in the audience. So make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Again, it's called The Daily Creative with Todd Henry. Also, today's episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. So I know we have a lot of small business owners who listen to the Axon Creative Podcast. Do you remember when you started your small business? I do. It was no small feat. It took a lot of late nights, early mornings, and the occasional all-nighter. And the reality is that sometimes we still have to put in the all-nighters, right? The bottom line is that you've probably been insanely busy ever since. It's just the nature of running your own business. So why not make things a little bit easier? Our friends at FreshBooks have the solution. FreshBooks invoicing and accounting software is designed specifically for small business owners. It's simple, it's intuitive, and it keeps you way more organized than a dusty shoebox filled with crumpled receipts. We absolutely love FreshBooks at Accidental Creative. You can create and send professional looking invoices in about 30 seconds. You can get them paid up to 2 times faster with automated online payments. You can file expenses quicker and keep them perfectly organized for tax time. And the best part is that FreshBooks will grow right alongside your business. You'll always have the tools you need when you need them. And a lot of services is kind of a bait and switch, right? It's like great when you start, but then as you grow, it becomes prohibitively expensive. That's not the way it is with FreshBooks. FreshBooks will grow right alongside your business. You'll always have the tools you need when you need them without ever having to learn the ins and outs of accounting. So join the 24 million people who have used FreshBooks. Try it free for 30 days with no catch and no credit card required, which is incredibly rare. Just go to freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental creative in the how did you hear about us section to get started. That's freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental creative in the how did you hear about us section. We thank FreshBooks for sponsoring this episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast. Well, it's great to have on the show today, Lucas Conley. Lucas is the co-author of a new book called Legacy in the Making, Building a Long-Term Brand to Stand Out in a Short-Term World. I love that subtitle, by the way, Lucas. And he's also a writer at the Legacy Lab. Lucas, welcome to the Axon Creative Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
So I think just sort of out of the gate, I think it'd be a good idea just to kind of get a sense of this word legacy. You know, it's a word that we sometimes hear tossed around, but I don't know that anybody really has a great definition of what legacy means. How do you define legacy?
That's a good question to start, because actually it is a pivotal question for the way the research started for us. Mark and I work out here in the advertising industry in LA, and one of the things we notice as consultants is that when we speak to people about building brands, the word legacy has a lot of stigma. A lot of people will look at a legacy and say, I want to keep that exactly the way it is. The other half of managers will look at the word legacy and say, I need to drop all of that. That's the old way of doing things. I'm trying to make my mark, and we need to do it differently to catch the, you know, current trend. The result is you have, you know, static brands or brands that have been radically changed and consumers often don't recognize. And what we found was there was a middle road, what we refer to in the book as modern legacy, of bringing what works from the past and being drawn by the future to forge something new in the present. But that very few people were taking that road.
So what are some reasons that you find that, I mean, I think some of them might be obvious, but then there are some that are probably beneath the surface reasons why people dig their heels in and often just latch on to the past and refuse to embrace where things are going or better ways of serving the people that they're trying to serve.
Well, certainly a lot of people revere the past. One of the quotes we heard when we were doing the initial research that really stuck was from an executive that said, "Listen, I don't want to be the guy that changes the recipe for Coke." So you've got, you know, a sense of people who revere the past, a sense of people who might be a little too scared to change what worked in the past. The past works. You know, if you look at brands that hold on to their legacies, they are able to kind of fight an incremental battle of inches and hold on to market share. But that does dwindle after time. So, you know, versus radically changing, it's a better bet to maybe try and keep what worked in the past. But over a long enough period of time, neither of those strategies will have the longevity that people would like.
You know, it's interesting that I mean, we're talking about brands, we're talking about organizations here, but I think so many of the same principles apply to individuals as well, right? When you think about how reticent we often are to let go of something that's worked really well for us in the past and embrace new skills, new aptitudes, new ways of thinking about our work in the world. I think some people are guilty. Well, all of us, I think, from time to time are guilty of saying the same thing. Well, this has worked. This has got me where I am. So why would I change horses in the middle of a race kind of thing?
Yeah. It is true. And what something we recognized just in writing this book was that all of these stories that we tell come back to people, you know, whether they're people who founded their own brands or they're what we call refounders, people who took over for someone else. While their stories at some level about the brand, the business, they're really about the person and the long-term personal ambition that drives that person. Mm-hmm. So whether you're working for someone else at a company or you're driving your own brand, what we ended up writing was a book for both.
Yeah. So the book is really built around the work that you do at the Legacy Lab. And first of all, could you just describe to us what the work is? What is the Legacy Lab? What do you guys do?
Sure. So the Legacy Lab is a consultancy. It's based out of an advertising agency called Team One here in Los Angeles. And the goal when we started, or at least the idea when we started, was to, you know, get a better handle on what people meant by legacy, to envision perhaps how some of these older brands, there was a fascinating stat we ran into when we first started that in the 1920s, the average S&P 500 company would last 67 years. Today, that number is closer to 15 years. Mm. So we're seeing this real churn with these older companies. These larger, you know, dominant companies are turning over very quickly these days. And we thought, well, this service would be very compelling to some of these very large companies that are trying to maintain their legacies. What's actually been true is we've seen a lot of younger companies, new companies, startups, tech companies that have approached the Legacy Lab for a leg up. Because they might come out with one great product, they might have kind of a flash in the pan of relevance, and they don't want to lose that. They want to continue their vision and continue to be relevant after that one great product. So the result is we've actually seen a lot of younger businesses come in the door that we didn't expect, who are interested in building a legacy.
And that's fantastic. All right. So I want to talk about the core transformations that you describe in the book, Legacy in the Making. There really are five, I guess, core transformations that we need to make to transfer from a short-term thinker to a long-term thinker in terms of legacy. And the first one is from institutional to personal. What does this mean?
Sure. So in the past, businesses typically followed organizational principles. So you'd see, you know, an IBM that had a certain way of doing things that was very scalable. What we're finding with businesses today is that people are following their long-term personal ambitions and really making a lot of headway with that. It's resonating with consumers. It's the type of business that feels right for today. And those personal ambitions are very unique to each company, and that feels more authentic.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that we often think of organizations as these big, cold, you know, apathetic institutions, which, I mean, you know, I think traditionally when we think of companies, it's how we think of them. But really the best companies are companies that at the core of it have some kind of personality, some sort of personal stake. You can see that they have skin in the game, right? And that's what sort of causes them to resonate in some capacity, is that they have planted their flag and they sort of have a personal side to what they do.
Yes, yes. And you can feel it because these things are often very timely and topical and relevant. The first story we tell in the book about contribution before extraction is a story about the Tribeca Film Festival. There's a story where the founders actually launched that festival following 9/11 in New York to help Lower Manhattan get back on its feet. So there was a very personal connection because the founders were coming out of the film world as well as living in Lower Manhattan. So you see this with a lot of businesses where there's just that immediate resonance for authenticity, where you think, okay, this is not somebody profiteering or taking advantage of an opportunity. This is somebody who truly has a reason to be in this business.
Yeah. And I think it's so important today because I think so many of us are very skeptical, right? I think our initial posture as potential consumers is skepticism. You're trying to sell me something. And the moment that we begin to reveal what's really beneath the surface, that we really are in the game with you, I think it makes a massive difference in terms of resonance with the people that we're trying to serve. So the second transformation that you write about, I found this so fascinating, is from attitudinal to behavioral. What does this mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is about posturing versus actually behaving your beliefs. You'll see a lot of brands in the past would typically say one thing and do another. And this you could get away with this because we didn't really have the transparency that we have in the modern day. You know, a major company could kind of have a PR campaign, and for the most part, most people would have to believe that's more or less how they behaved unless somebody in the media got a hold of the truth. Well, nowadays with social media, with the way the internet allows information to travel, that's just not really possible. And the result is that you could either continue to behave that way and be called out, or there are brands that are truly leading with their beliefs that are showing and demonstrating that works even better.
Yeah. So one story I would love for you to share a little bit of is the story of the Bluebird Cafe. I spent a lot of time in Nashville in my 20s, as I now call them to my children, my misguided 20s when I was a wannabe musician, right? But I spent a lot of time at the Bluebird Cafe, and I thought this story was really fascinating. Could you share the story of kind of the evolution and then ultimate sort of transfer of the Bluebird Cafe and what happened there?
Yeah, this is a really good one, actually, because it does have a couple generations. And what we really love to show with these brands is that they transcend generations, that when you have a modern legacy brand, it's not just something that one person can carry forward, but it's that something that multiple generations will carry on after you. So the Bluebird Cafe began in 1982, and it was the brainchild of a woman named Amy Kurland, who got a little small inheritance from her grandmother and decided to start a restaurant. She didn't know a lot about it. She started serving lunch and dinner, and her boyfriend at the time said, "Would you put a stage in there because, you know, my band could come and play?" Well, this thing took on a whole new life, and pretty soon she dropped the lunch menu, and she was having two shows a day, and she really lit up this Nashville community because she was willing to open the door to anybody. You know, she wasn't just saying you have to have, you know, a record produced or you have to have a certain level of talent to come in here. Like, you could come in there as an undiscovered artist and really get be heard and find an audience. And in fact, the result is that people like Garth Brooks, Taylor Swift have launched their careers and really helped their careers over the years at the Bluebird Cafe, and it's become something of a, you know, an icon. What we love is, so Amy Kurland retired in 2007, and she passed the brand on to a group called the National Songwriters Association International, led by a woman named Erica Woolham Nichols. Erica has been able to take the brand even farther. And this is what we were talking about with traditional legacy, you know, not changing anything, versus modern legacy, actually drawing from the past and moving towards the future. Rather than keeping the Bluebird exactly like it is, she's actually been able to reach new audiences by introducing the Bluebird to the show Nashville, which was on ABC for a while and then on another network. She's brought the Bluebird to places like New York and Los Angeles, where it sponsors shows and actually curates and produces shows with the Grand Ole Opry. They have a summer concert series in Sundance. But what she hasn't done is change the location. She hasn't changed the way they run things. She hasn't changed all the quirky parts of the Bluebird that make the Bluebird the Bluebird. So, in other words, she hasn't sold out, which would have been very easy with the popularity that she gained.
Sure.
So it really is a good example of behaving your beliefs.
And it would have been really easy, by the way, for Amy Curlin to do the same thing. I mean, she had built a substantial business, right? And could have just sold it to the highest bidder and said, all right, I'm going to pull the ripcord on my parachute and just kind of float into retirement or whatever. But she really cared deeply about the core driving principles that made the Bluebird what it is. And so I think just all around, like you said, this is, it would not surprise me if 50 years from now, the Bluebird Cafe is still going. It's still, you know, it'll look different, but it's still a thing because those roots are so deep.
Yeah. You know, the way they set that up, it really is fascinating. You don't find too many founders who are willing to pass their brand forward to a nonprofit. And that was what she was willing to do to preserve the legacy that she had set up. Yeah. There are examples out there. There are people who believe like that, but that's why they're so rare. And that's why, you know, you have to collect them in a book like this.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about what it means to go from commanding to influential.
Absolutely. So commanding and controlling would be the typical model of advertising in the past or branding in the past, where you'd have a very large company like, say, Coca-Cola or Ford, and you'd run your campaign, and that would be what you'd tell consumers, is that these are the cars, these are the people that should buy them, and these are the prices. And there's you know, a very traditional way of doing things and communicating with consumers. All of that has changed dramatically with social media and the transparency of the web. Today, that just looks old-fashioned. And the result is that brands that are able to adapt and embrace social media and incorporate that type of communication, where they're harnessing the energy of consumers and actually getting involved with consumers, those brands are influencing social movements.
And it's interesting because, you know, really the best brands, the brands that we really resonate with and love, are movement brands, aren't they? They're brands that, you know, they are seen as the leader of a movement, not as the chief purveyor of goods and services. I mean, I think all the way back to the 90s, you know, with Apple. I know it's sort of the everybody kind of gravitates there, right? But like, it's the here's to the crazy ones. Like, I want to be a crazy one. I want to be part of that, right? And it's interesting how, you know, these brands become leaders of movements, and it's, hey, let's lock arms and walk forward together.
Yeah. You basically see brands that are allowing the consumers to help tell the story. We give a few examples in the book, like Red, the San Diego Zoo, and the It Gets Better project. The last one there is a really inspiring story about a group of folks who started a company to encourage teenagers that who are LGBTQ that life gets better after their teens when they're maybe facing bullying in a small town. And so they encourage people to post videos online and share those videos of their own personal stories. The result is, you know, the brand is kind of the creation of the users. And you do see a lot of brands that are leaning this way now, letting go of control and saying, you know, maybe you have a better way of using our product and you can share that online. Or maybe you should share your story of how your product is, our product has influenced your life.
Yeah. Fantastic. All right. Let's talk about what it means to go from episodic to perpetual.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So episodic innovation was and is how a lot of companies will innovate when it's necessary. The classic story that I love telling is, you know, Kodak actually invented the digital camera back in, I think, say 1974. And they sat on that innovation because they already had digital or regular film. And they thought, why would we introduce a new innovation when we've owned the market for film? And, you know, of course, the result is they were ultimately usurped and left behind. Perpetual adaptation is what Mark and I describe as the current mode that's really driving change in the world today. These are companies that that never stop innovating. They never stop looking for ways to change.
I love that. And then the final transformation you talk about is from orthodox to unconventional.
Yes. Yes. So too often you see companies that they say, like, I want to be the best in our category. And that's what we just think of that as a fine mindset, but it's the wrong mindset for today. The companies that are pioneering unconventional solutions are saying, I want to be the only one in my category. Mm-hmm. These are brands that are designing entirely new ways of doing things.
Yeah. And so what are some examples? What is an example of a company that has made this transition really well?
Sure. Well, so Lexus is a good one. Lexus is a company here that says we're going to design vehicles with working with cities. So they actually work with cities on the way roads are being built in the future to actually get into the innovative state of mind of how the vehicles will be incorporated into those systems. That's a wildly innovative world right now with automated driving kind of and driverless cars kind of entering the road. Another easy one to think of is Grey Goose. Here's a vodka that came on the market back in 1997 and was literally twice as expensive as everything else. It was made in France, which didn't make any sense to anybody. And it was made like a wine. It was finally made in an artisanal manner. At the time, all vodkas basically were Slavic. They were coming out of the Eastern Europe area. And they were supposed to be tasteless. They were supposed to be somewhat unrefined. And they were supposed to be cheap. So when you see brands that really violate the rules like that of their category, either expanding the category or making an entirely new category, that's when we're starting to see a brand that's more of a modern legacy brand.
Wow. That's fantastic. I love that. So one of the examples you give near the end of the book is Taylor Guitars. And I have a special affinity for Taylor Guitars. I have a Taylor that I bought, probably 25 years ago now. And it's in a case. It's in my basement. It's one of the few guitars I kept. And the reason I kept it is because I want to be able to pass it along, right? And this is something you used to do only with like Martins or, some of the like legacy brands, right? That you think of, not legacy in the way we're talking about it, but sort of the brands that you think of as sort of the stalwarts of the guitar world. But Taylor really up until recently wasn't really thought of as that kind of a brand, was it?
No, and I don't know that even the founders themselves envisioned the outcome of the reality that has come to bear today. This is a brand that was just very innovative. The Bob Taylor was known for doing things in an unconventional way, breaking the neck of a guitar to fix it. For example, is something that was considered sacrilege. And he would say this is just the fastest way to fix this problem. The result is the brand really over the years developed some wonderful innovations that people began to realize make their guitars very playable. They pointed out when we spoke to them, if you speak to people in surveys, what are the most playable instruments that people really enjoy playing? Because most guitar players are hobbyists. Taylor would consistently, win out in those surveys. Today, Taylor is actually in a very interesting transition where they've looked for their successor in real time rather than, say, selling the brand, to another manufacturer or to a private equity company. They're handing it forward to their master luthier, who's a guy named Andy Powers. This is a guy who's as innovative as Bob Taylor was in the early days of his career, but in entirely different ways. So he has redesigned the guts of a Taylor guitar now. He's looking at designing new instruments entirely, things that we wouldn't even describe as guitars, but he envisions a whole new world of instruments. So this is a very innovative brand that built its name on being willing to change.
Oh, I love that. That's great. Well, this has been such a fascinating conversation. The book dives obviously so much more deeply into each of these transformations, and I found it not just applicable as I'm thinking about my business, but very applicable as I think about me personally, right? And the legacy that I am growing and developing. Lucas, what's the best place for people to go if they want to learn more about you and the work that you do at the Legacy Lab?
Oh, thanks, Todd. I think the best place to start is thelegacylab.com. They can find out more about the work we do, either the consulting practice that we have or some of our nonprofit work. We have a variety of different offshoots that are fairly interesting there. And of course, you can find the book anywhere like Amazon.com. So take a look there too.
Fantastic. Well, Lucas, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Yes, thank you very much, Todd. It's been a pleasure.
And as always, thank you for listening. If you like this episode, make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts or join the conversation at collective.accidentalcreative.com. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time.